Sir, our next question is about a surgical procedure known as lobotomy, which is an operation involving incision into the brain. So it was formerly used to treat mental illnesses, that is based on Google Reads. And in the film Shutter Island, it has been used as a method to erase the memories of the criminally insane in order to treat them. So to what extent do you think this claim is true?
Well, you know, if you, I mean, that's how most brain regions have been discovered, right? Through lesioning, and then you see, so you do lesion in a part of brain region, and then you see what brain function is primarily affected. So that's how we knew up until recently which brain region is controlling different functions. So it definitely makes sense that you could damage a particular brain region and have a major impact on memory. Today, of course, we have very interesting system, at least in mice. We're using optogenetics, which is a very similar idea, but instead of lesioning the system, what we can do is we could label neurons with a particular tag, and then using a blue light or yellow light, we can actually activate those neurons, suppress those neurons. So you can teach mouse a trick. And then as mouse learns the trick, the activated neurons are being labeled by a particular molecule called chorionrhodopsin. And then you can actually put the blue light into the brain, activate those same neurons, and then mouse will perform the memory that it learned, whatever task it learned, you can actually induce mouse doing the task. And likewise, with the yellow light, actually you can suppress these neurons. And so mouse is doing some task that it's learned, and then you're suppressing those neurons, and the mouse will forget the task. You can put mouse to sleep, you can wake up mouse, you can make mouse turn left and right and jump and do all kinds of different things. So this approach is fantastic. It's amazing. The guy who kind of brought it into our conscience and to all the neuroscience masses is Karl Deisseroff from Stanford. So there is a great amount of work which today, so if before we had to do lesion, today we can just, you know, activate or deactivate very small areas of the brain using this very elegant technique and understand which exact area is involved in. But yes, but erasing memories is not, again, erasing memories in mice, I should say, in mice is absolutely not science fiction. Even we can do it. It's an easy thing, as long as you do it in mice.
Okay, so okay. That was good. Can't we do it on humans? Like, what if we try to do it on humans?
It involves to do optogenetics. I think one day there probably will be some sort of technique to go into humans, right? Because the idea that you are able, you know, the example, so Suzumu Tanegawa published a beautiful paper a couple of years ago where he showed, for example, that in Alzheimer's mice, the problem is not with learning. The problem is with memory retrieval. And so he showed very nicely that even if he takes a very old mice, Alzheimer's mice, and then they cannot, he teaches them the trick, and then they don't remember the trick, right? But with this approach, he showed that you can actually retrieve this memory. So the memory is stored. So mice did learn, and the memory was stored. Now we can retrieve the memory, and mouse will do the task. So the potential is huge, right? Because basically you have, if really in all people, we have the memory stored, and the problem is just with the retrieval, and you can actually retrieve them forcefully, if you wish, through this external activation. This is fantastic. When it will be in humans, I don't know. But will we ever be able to do these kind of approaches in humans? I don't know. Maybe yes. You know, when I was an undergrad some years ago, I remember anatomy professor told me anatomy. He told me that he likes anatomy and not neuroscience. Because anatomy is a finite thing. You whatever is known is known. Whatever is not known, whether it's irrelevant. So we know everything, and we can teach it from A to Z. And it's, neuroscience is very difficult because A, every day something new comes up, and it goes. And I don't believe that the machine will understand by itself how this machine works. He goes. So he believed that we.
So, Dr. Kipnis, let's talk about schizophrenia. So schizophrenia is a disorder that could be affected by the immune system. So since schizophrenia is also more likely to affect those who have a family history of the illness, do you think a part of the reason is because of the similarities in immune system between family members?
Well, no, it's an interesting question, right? So I think schizophrenia, so I'm not an expert in schizophrenia. I do know about earlier works on the immune system and schizophrenia. Some there was a claim that maybe schizophrenia is an autoimmune disease, which I think is not the case as far as I understand. Again, I think that there is an immune component to any neurological, any psychiatric or most psychiatric diseases. I do not know, I'm not aware of works that are showing this, you know, very strong component of immunity in schizophrenia. I remember I was extremely interested in this disease. Unfortunately, the mouse models for schizophrenia are, there are some mouse models, but they are not, they don't, of course, represent all the spectrum of symptoms that we see in humans. And so we're not studying schizophrenia, at least not in mice, at least not in animals. So we don't do it. It would be very interesting to look at immune responses in schizophrenia. I cannot tell you really much.
Okay, so there's another thing that I just noticed in that question, which is like, are there striking similarities between the immune systems of like closely genetically related people, like for example family members? Do certain aspects get genetically transferred across generations?
Well, so of course we all have the very, very unique MHC molecules, right? And so if you have identical twins, you will have identical MHC. But otherwise, you know, we each get a copy of our mother and father, so our immune system will be different. And so sometimes parents will be going back to transplant donors. Sometimes parents or siblings will be very good match, and sometimes they will not be. So you could have your mother's nose, your father's nose, or none of their nose, right? You could have a very unique nose.
Yeah.
Maybe not a very good example, but I mean, same idea I think is with the immune system, right? So it may be you may have similarity, and you may not. What you do have for sure among family members is a microbiome. And a microbiome, of course, affects your immune system and maybe trains your immune system. So I think in terms of what your immune system has experienced over the period of your development and your growth, I think probably will be very similar to what your siblings will have and also similar to what your parents will have. So in this regard, probably yes, right? So you may respond, if there is a new pathogen, you probably will respond to it, hopefully, as a family in a similar manner. But of course, there are so many additional factors, the microbiome, which affect how immune system works, that, I mean, it's extremely complicated system. And understanding the HLAs and understanding the TCR is a beautiful concept. I don't know if you guys know about how T cell receptor, B cell receptor, it's all somatic recombination, right? So basically it's a recombination which happens after the cell was already present. And basically pieces of DNA are being stitched together to create this variable region of T cell receptor and B cell receptor. A beautiful, beautiful concept. Basically, you have an unlimited number of, if we were to clone all the T cell receptors in our genome, it probably would take, I don't know what, 10 times more genome just for that. And so instead, you have these different regions which just come together in each cell type, right? And so each T cell is very, very unique. And there is no T cell which is identical to that one, unless this one actually proliferates and then becomes clone. And now you have, so basically, if you find two T cells, which have the same T cell receptor, it means that they're coming from the same parent. They either divided or it's another cell which divided and gave this 2 or 4 or 8 cells. So extremely complicated system.
That does sound complicated. So let's talk about placebo now. So placebo is anything that seems to be a real medical treatment, but it's basically tricking a person into believing that he's being treated. If a person expects the pill to do something, it's possible that the body's own chemistry might induce effects similar to what a medication might have caused. So, in your opinion, how effective do you think this treatment is, and in what scenarios?
Well, actually, I have a good friend. She's professor at Technion, which is Israeli Institute of Technology in Israel. Asya Rolls, you may actually want to have her on your show as well. And so what she's showing very, very nicely, so we're training in the same lab, as PhD students in Michal Schwartz's lab. And so what Asia shows very nicely is that placebo, well, again, this is in the mice, right? But in mice, you show that you could activate a particular brain region which most probably responding to placebo, and that brain region activates immune system, and that immune system then goes back and fights whatever the problem. So she shows very nicely in response to immunotherapy, immune response to cancers, and she claims that you can actually show you can activate immune system through the brain, which is a very exciting concept. So I think it's the same idea, right? So when you are convinced that things will go better, and then you know you're getting this therapy, which will definitely help you, you could I can envision how you could activate your immune system to the level that it now becomes more activated and then more efficient. Will this be a therapy for major diseases? Most probably not, right? You may have some improvement, maybe temporarily improvement, but then of course you need something that will actually target the problem. So but placebo effect is real. I mean, we all know it's real, right? And understanding how it works is, I think, it's super interesting. And suggesting it works through brain-immune communication is quite exciting.
So it might differ from person to person, right? Even if the disease is, like, to the same extent, it might work well on someone and not work on someone else.
Well, some people are more believers than others, right? Yeah, so some people are more can get exactly.
So I heard this somewhere that 50% of your disease is cured if you feel you're okay. So I think that's placebo.
You know, actually, interesting thing, right? We're all interested in placebo effect as to work instead of medication. I wonder how much the negativity of the patient interferes with the function of the actual drug, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and so I mean, maybe that's what we need to study, right? How the patient itself maybe interferes. I mean, yeah, I think positive people are, I think optimism is a good feature. No?
Yeah. Something we need right now.
We definitely need it right now.
So, doctor, we'd like you to talk to our aspiring neuroscientists, one of them being me. So what is the scope for research and studies for young students in the field of pathology and neuroscience? Like, are there any specific issues researchers can work on?
So, no, when I was a kid, I was extremely, so I knew that I want to be a scientist since I remember myself. I thought one has to be a doctor because my family were all doctors. And so I believe that one needs to be a doctor to be a researcher. But then I realized that you can skip the MD part and just be a PhD scientist. I think it's very cool to be MD. If today I was choosing again, if my kids want to do research, I would advise them to do MD PhD because I think understanding a holistic approach to diseases in humans is a great thing. And then, of course, delving into science, I think you can ask even more interesting questions as an MD PhD. So I personally miss this a little bit, this understanding of a human disease. But anyway, so when I was a kid, I remember that I knew I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to cure a cancer, and I was very, very worried that by the time I grow up, all cancers will be cured. Well, unfortunately, even though we made a huge progress, we're not there yet, right? So I think with the brain diseases, it's definitely there, right? I don't think that, my daughter asked me one day, when she was younger, she asked me, what will happen to me? Will I lose my job when we cure all neurological diseases? And I said, in theory, maybe yes, but in reality, I don't think this day will come, not in my lifetime, unfortunately, right? So, but if you're asking me for the area of neuroscience, I am very, very biased. First of all, neuroscience is fascinating, it's very, very interesting, but I think this understanding of how these two most complicated systems, I'm kind of finishing with what we started, right? How two most complex systems in our body. One is the CNS, which is multicellular, right? It's static. It sits in one place and controls the entire body. And on the other hand, and it's composed of a bunch of different cells. On the other hand, you have an immune system, which is composed of a bunch of different cells. It's mobile. It's everywhere. And again, it controls everything in the body, right? The two systems are working on understanding the they both work based on memories, right? So we remember something, and therefore our behavior is affected by our memories. Immune system behavior is affected by its memories, right? They both, even the when there is interaction between two cells in the immune system, we call this a synapse, right? There is a regular neurological synapse and immunological synapse. And interestingly enough, through work of Carla Schatz, for example, we know that immune molecules like MHC, which we discussed before, is expressed on neurons and is needed for neurological synapse, right? So I think the two systems are extremely, there's a bunch of identical things, a bunch of similarities, yet these are two completely different systems and very, very complex ones. So if I have to give you, if my daughter was asking me what she needs to, what would I advise her to study in neuroscience, I would absolutely tell her that neuroimmunology, I think, it's already the next frontier. It will not be the next frontier. I think it's already the next frontier of neuroscience. So yes, I would say neuroimmunology. And neuroimmunology of disease, neuroimmunology of homeostasis, I think there is so many different options of where to go from there.
It's really a joy to hear you speak. You know, it's really informative.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Vishnu. And thank you, Shreya. Any other questions?
Yes, a couple of them. Like, we'll just...
Okay.
Do you mind sharing your journey with us, like, from childhood till where you have reached now?
Oh, the journey. The journeys are not that interesting. I think what's interesting along the journey is to be lucky enough. I really believe that... Okay, so it was many years ago. I was a graduate student in Michal Schwartz lab at the Weizmann Institute. And this old professor once came. His name is Michael Sila. He didn't get Nobel Prize, but he has almost all other, I think he has all other prizes. He got the, I think he got the Lasker Award, if I'm not mistaken. He got Wolf Award, so he got almost everything for TCR image recognition. Actually, very, very amazing scientist. Today, I think he's probably 95, 96. Back then, he was much younger, but still quite old. He came to lab, and my mentor, Michal Schwartz, who used to be his graduate student, introduced me to him. And then he told me that he said in science, the most important word in English is serendipity. And it said when it's, and so because the success in science is when a luck meets prepared mind, right? Because so often we just miss very, very interesting discoveries just because the mind is not prepared. So what I think, I was lucky enough to be in places where there was a lot of opportunities, A, to be prepared, and B, to have a lot of serendipity. And so, you know, I was just lucky enough to be in places where things were just happening. And I happened to be around. So I think in science, luck is very important. But on the other hand, I think that if you work hard and if you have intuition and passion, then I don't think there is a way not to be a successful graduate student or postdoc or, you know, initially a young PI. I think you will make this all the steps if that's what you want, and then if you're willing to work hard and, you know, having good intuition to a problem, right? And asking the question, right? I think the problem is when people are waiting, so some students or some postdocs are waiting to be given a problem. That's not working very well, right? What works in my opinion, what works really well is when people come and they have this burning question, burning idea that they want to explore, and then I think they just delve into it, and, you know, and I mean, science is a very consuming. It's like being an artist, right? I don't think scientists and artists are very. I don't know. I don't presume to know. A life of an artist, but I think it's not very different because sometimes the muse comes at night, right? And so you can't sleep because you need to write this particular thing, or you wake up with this cool idea, you want to write it down, or you want to do a literature search and see what has been done in this regard. So I think that if you're looking for a comfortable, quiet, and, you know, nice life, that's not the science life. It's a lot of stress, a lot of disappointment, right? Most experiments don't really work. hypotheses are being, as somebody, I forgot who said it, that the problem of science is that beautiful hypotheses are being slayed by ugly, ugly facts and ugly results, which, you know, go against the hypothesis. But still, I think it's extremely rewarding. If you really love, so that's why somebody once told me we need to be professional scientists. And I don't think you can be professional scientist. It's not a profession. I really think it's a way of life. And you either have it or don't have it. And I think it's okay not to have it. And so I was just lucky enough to either have it or to gain to be lucky to be in the places where this love for science was okay to share and to be vocal about and to be, you know, open about. And so I was trained in the lab of Michael Schwarz at the Weizmann Institute, and it was probably really one of my luckiest things that happened to me, that I was able to get into lab by complete serendipity, actually. So when I was a graduate student at Weizmann, I was working in the lab of Moshe Oren, the guy who cloned P53. You probably guys know the molecule, right? It's a major tumor suppressor. Yeah. Working with Moshe Oren's lab, and I was sure that I would go there and continue to be there. And then we had this open day, and these people presented this works, and then this very small, short lady comes out and, you know, presents these things. And I remember I couldn't understand much of what she was saying, but the enthusiasm and the excitement was absolutely infectious. And so I went to meet with her. I remember also I went quite late. It was, I think, was after 6 p.m. It was in the winter, it was dark, and I just bumped into her office. And she was there, and we scheduled a meeting in person and discussed the rotation. And then I joined the lab, and I never left. I still, even though I now... 15 years since I think we parted as a trainee and mentor, but we're still in touch all the time. And so, I think you need this luck to have a very healthy and very good lab environment and lab experience. Unfortunately, there are many students, unfortunately, not many, but there are students who don't experience this. And, you know, for some reasons, even in my own lab, I have students who have blast and those who don't enjoy that much, you know. And so it's all about the match. It's all about luck.
Yes. The baseline being curiosity and luck are very important in science.
Yes.
Okay, so I think that was it. Thank you so much for taking your time off for our audience. And it was very nice having you with us today.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, do you have any suggestions or any feedbacks regarding the interview we took right now?
Suggestions for what? For future, you mean? Or
I mean, if we happen to conduct any more interviews of any...
Oh, so, you know, I think that, again, I am biased, but I think you may want to talk with Asia Rolls. I think she's a fantastic speaker. So the last name is Rolls, and then the first name is Asya, Asya. Michal Schwarz will be very, very interesting, Michal and then Schwarz. These are from our field, right? I mean, there are a bunch of many other names. You know, I can send you a long list of people from our, again, I am a little biased. And so, you know, one person who you may really want to get on online is Tony Weiss-Corey, who is a phenomenal scientist from Stanford. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all this young blood, I'm sure you know the work of how young blood affects the brain, which is also beautiful, beautiful work. So, yeah. Okay. And there are many others. I mean, really, we're living in a... People who do science, I don't know how it was, of course, 50 years ago, but today it's really a blessing to be doing science, and, you know, everything is at your fingertips, right? Every new stuff that comes out, you see it right away, immediately on your screen. We used to go to the library, you know, and make copies of journals, and then, you know, reading those papers. And today everything is online. People upload their works way before they publish in bioarchive. So it's a blast. If you're excited about science, and if you are passionate about science and curious about science, this is a phenomenal. Again, it's hard to call it professional, but it's a phenomenal way of life.
Yes, I get that. Thank you so much, Dr. Kipnis.
My pleasure. Okay. My pleasure. Thank you as well, and have a good night.
Okay. Same to you, sir.
In touch. Bye bye. Okay. Thanks.
Bye bye.